Hello, I'm Peter Jones, and this is a podcast on behalf of Lancashire Authors Association. Sitting with me here today is our president, Sid Calderbank. Sid has been described as a Lancashire dialect historian. Good afternoon, Sid.
Good afternoon.
Right, so tell me about yourself from when you were a young lad, from when you were born.
Probably. Hey.
Whereabouts were you born? When? What was it like at the time, and what was growing up like with your family, your siblings?
What were it like? I was born on the 5th of November, Bonfire Night, 1952, in Charlie Hospital. The first child to my parents, Ron and Rose Calderbank. And I came out of hospital, and we went back to my grandfather's house at number 25 Townley Street, where my mum and dad were living with my dad's parents at the time. And so I spent the first 18 months of my life in number 25 Townley Street in Charlie, opposite Lawrence's Mill.
Right. And yeah, what? Tell me about your brothers and sisters and playing out. What was it like?
Well, eventually I had another brother who were 18 months younger than me. And then my dad got his own house because he was creating too much trouble back with my grandparents. There were only little houses. There were only two up and two down houses. But he bought his own at number 29 Collery Street. There's a romantic address for you. Number 29 Collery Street in Charlie. And I lived there, me and my brother Alan, and my mum and dad, we lived there until I were 13. And me and our kid used to go to Duke Street County Primary School, which is actually one of the best primary schools in Charlie. And we went there, which were only two streets away, and we played out round the mill, the factory that were on Lee Street. We played in the school catering kitchens, which were also on Lee Street. We climbed over the wall and played in Slaughterhouse Yard, which were on Back Street. And there were a little fire station, a ambulance station, at Council Slaughterhouse down there, and it were a proper old-fashioned Lancashire upbringing.
Wow, you don't get that these days, do you?
No, and we fought it muck and dirt, and we climbed over factory walls at Mill Lodge and built rafts and boats to go sailing about on them, pumped in trying to catch this big goldfish that lived at Mill Lodge. Oh. We never caught it. We got a digging once or twice when we fought it, but we never caught it. But it kept us occupied.
What were you like at school? Were you a bright student? What were you interested in?
I were at Duke Street. I passed me 11 plus and went to Charlie Grammar School, which were just brand new opened. It's now called Parklands, and it's a comprehensive, and it's halfway down Southport Road. But when I went there, it was just brand new built Charlie Grammar School, and I arrived there really feeling completely out of my depth. Probably like some of these young fellas today that hear about getting places in, you know, Oxford and Cambridge universities and whatnot. They're bright, they're clever, and they've earned a place, but they don't feel right when they're there. They're not mixed, they're not with right folk.
No, I can
and
understand that. Yeah.
It were difficult for me to fit in with a lot of the other folk that were around in that school. I was very bright. Mm-hmm. I was, in first year, I were top of the entire first year in English and French, which was, you know, when I look back on it, it was a remarkable performance. Mm-hmm. But after a couple of years of that, I rebelled against it. Mm-hmm. And I was one of the original 1960s dropouts, and I didn't have any patience at all for the system, and I reacted by rebelling against it.
So did you become an angry young man?
I became an angry young man, yes, and I have mellowed only a bit in later life, yeah.
Oh, that's good. I mean, it is good that you, and probably because when you think about grammar schools, think about privileged kids, don't you, from really rich backgrounds, and they seem to look down on the kids who are just as bright as them, but come from poorer backgrounds.
Oh, aye. Yeah. And it was, it was very obvious, and I felt it, you know. And you felt a lot of pressure.
It's a sad indictment, isn't it?
It is a sad indictment. Now, my brother and my sister both went to comprehensive schools, secondary modern schools, and they had a lot better time at school than I had. Yeah, they really did, you know.
And are your brother and sister younger or older than you?
My brother's 18 months younger, and he became a restaurateur. And he did very well for himself, and he's now living in South of Wales, retired. And my sister, who's a full 10 years younger than me, she started off. She went to Wellfield Secondary School in Leyland because family moved for a bit to Leyland, and she became a nurse, and she has moved her own way up through the nursing profession. And now she's a medical lecturer in South Bank University in London.
Wow.
Lecturing young doctors on trauma nursing and so on.
So when you're at school, did you leave with any qualifications? I mean, it'd be GCEs then, what?
It were GCEs. I passed my English and my French GCE because I couldn't help it. and that's the truth of the matter. I couldn't help it. I did no work at all at school. I took what I wanted from them, and I left as fast as I could, and as soon as I could, and went off to Leyland Motors.
All right, so that's where you started. Well, we'll talk about a little bit more about your working life after we've heard the first piece of music that you picked for me today, and it's Stanley Holloway with Sam's Medal. So we'll listen to it now, and then we'll have a little chat about why you picked this piece afterwards.
You've heard of Samuel Small, perhaps, a lad of bulldog breed, who saved his sergeant major's life, a most unusual deed. At Waterloo he fought and bled, and when the war was won, the king a medal struck for Sam, because of what he'd done. So Sam came up to palace gates, in famous London town, a sentry in a busby hat was walking up and down. The sentry stopped and looked at Sam. "Excuse me, mate," said he. "Might you be Private Samuel Small?" And Sam said, "Ah, that's me." "Well, go on in," said sentry, "quick," and gave the gate a slam. "King's got a medal there for thee." "Oh, no, he has," said Sam. Well, Sam pushed open palace door and stood in holy hush. He found himself inside a room, all marble busts and plush. Archbishop in a red cocked hat and breeches white and blue, said, "Is your name Sam Small, my lad?" "It is," said Sam. "How do?" "Don't loiter then," says Bishop Sharp, "like nursemaid wi' a pram. The king's got medal there for thee." "Oh, no, he has," said Sam. Upstairs, Sam met Prime Minister, a top hat on his head. His trousers, they was velveteen. One leg was blue, one red. He glanced at Sam all haughty-like and asked him, "Might you be a man called Private Samuel Small?" And Sam said, "Aye, that's me." "Well, don't keep King all night," he said. "Surprised at thee I am. He's got thy medal there as king." "Oh, no, he has," said Sam. But when Sam came on king and queen, his awe he couldn't smother, for there sat king, one hand out thob, and sceptre was in t'other. Sam grasped the situation like in less than half a jiff. He gave a very smart salute and knocked his hat skew whiff. "Thou must be Samuel Small," said King. "That's right," said Sam, "I am." "Well, I've a medal here for thee." "I know thou hast," said Sam. "Don't be impatient, Sam," says King, "before 'tis handed you. There's certain grave formalities which must be gotten through." The VC's granted Samuel Small, the King began to read. for saving Sergeant Major's life. A most unusual deed. Dragged him to safety under fire when serving in the line. Now tell me, Sam, how came you do this deed so brave and fine? Well now, said Sam, 'twas like this here. That Sergeant Major come towards our trenches very drunk, a waving jar of rum. And just as we was letting forth a loud triumphant shout, a darn great gun, excuse me, Queen, went off and laid him out. I rushed and grabbed the precious jar. He seized me round the tomb. Your pardon, Queen. So he got saved, as well as jar of rum. But if there'd been no rum, said King, though death might sound his knell, thou wouldst have done that same brave deed. I would, said Sam, like hell. Did you hear that, said King to Queen? She said, indeed I did. Don't give him ruddy medal then. And nor they never did.
That was Sam's Medals by Stanley Holloway. Can you tell me a little bit more about why you picked that piece?
I picked that because it was the first dialect, in inverted commas, monologue that I committed to memory when I was 14 years of age. And my dad had a couple of books of Stanley Holloway's monologues. And I picked it up and I leafed through it and I thought, this is my language. This is better than learning Ozymandias to keep English master happy, you know. And so I learned it and I used to go around reciting it to myself. And that was my first, it was the first time I discovered that you could write the way that we were talking. It suddenly felt like I belong here in this Lancashire dialect stuff. And that was the one that it just opened the door a little bit, and I could see what were happening beyond it.
There's a guy who wrote those called Miles Mallison or something like that.
No, that Sam's Medals was written by Stanley Holloway himself.
Oh, he wrote it himself?
Yes.
Oh.
Stanley Holloway started off with the very famous one, the Oud Sam, which is, we've got the Sam pick up the musket line in it. Mm. And Holloway was an actor in London.
Well, that's what I thought.
Yes, he was an actor and raconteur and comedian on the London stage and into films and whatnot. And he developed this reciting monologues after he'd been attached to a Yorkshire regiment at First World War. And he got, yeah, and that gave him an insight into this sort of dry northern humour that we all love so much. And he started mucking about with it, and he created this Oud Sam figure. And then he teamed up with Marriott Edgar, who was a professional scriptwriter and songwriter. And it was Marriott Edgar who created Mr. and Mrs. Ramsbottom and young Albert, their son, and took him off to Blackpool with his stick and his horse's head handle. So it was Marriott Edgar that came up with the things for which Stanley Holloway will forever be remembered.
Yeah, I'd often wondered that because I've heard Stanley Holloway in My Fair Lady and he couldn't get a bigger Cockney. And yet I thought, well, why is he, you know, and you've just explained it to me because he got to meet Yorkshire people in the Yorkshire Regiment and he took it from there.
Yeah.
The northern thing appealed to him, which is great.
And it was because he was an accomplished actor, and an actor ought to be able to do
absolutely
accents.
So we'll go back to you now. You just finished school and you were telling me you went to Leyland Motors. How long did you stay there and what did you do when you were there?
I did indeed. I went for an engineering apprenticeship at Leyland Motors. I just wanted a job and I went and got one. They used to take on hundreds of apprentices every year at Leyland Motors. They were very well organised. They had apprentice training centres, they had their own further education, college and everything. And I went there and I applied for a job and they took me and I became a technician apprentice. And I could have done, once again, all sorts of fancy things, mm-hmm. but I didn't want to do that because I was getting an even angrier young man then.
Oh, correct. Yeah.
And, And so I opted, once I'd come out of my time, once I'd served my apprenticeship and I were 20 year out, I took the dirtiest, nastiest job that nobody else wanted.
What was that?
That was turning on a great big Ward 10 combination lathe and turning rear wheel hubs for double-decker buses.
Oh, my gosh.
Part number 231690.
I even remember
that. And I went on permanent night shift because you got more money and more time off. And you work four nights a week and you got time and a third for 40 hours. And I made 13 of these things every night in a noisy old comic shop in Farrington Factory of Leyla Motors.
Mm-hmm.
And Leyla Motors were paying for me back and me hands. They weren't paying for me mind.
Oh, yeah.
And so I used to go to Leyland Library during the day. I used to grub around in their local history section, find all these books of Lancashire dialect songs and poems and stories, find a poem that would happen turn into a song, and I'd scribble it down on a piece of paper and photocopy it, shove it in my pocket, take it to work. And in this noisy factory, I'd learn it.
Mm-hmm.
And you could sing and shout as loud as you like. Nobody could hear you at all.
Lucky you could hear yourself.
Well, yeah, but it didn't matter because it allowed you to experiment with the range of where you got the pitch and everything.
Mm.
And by weekend, I had a new song. So then I used to go around folk clubs at weekend singing them.
Mm. So did you adapt these songs? Were they already written or did you write some yourself?
I only ever wrote things for fun. I just wrote light-hearted, jocular things about the people I worked with in the situations I were in and so on.
Mm.
They were successful, but that wasn't what I wanted to do because the more I got into this dialect, the further back I began to take it and look at what people had written 150 years before. And how they were reflecting their own lives. And there's emerging a social history that I'm suddenly finding out all these things about people that they'd written about their own lives. That all my other friends around folk clubs and all the other performers couldn't do. They couldn't read this out stuff. A lot of them couldn't read it at all. A lot of them didn't touch it because they haven't got a Lancashire accent. Those that had got a Lancashire accent, the Horton Weavers and the Mike Hardings and so on, they were creating a lot of their own things and they were doing sort of big public entertainments and becoming very, very popular. And I was looking for something that used to be massively popular, but 100 years ago. And I was finding stuff and finding pronunciations of words and spellings of words and authors and poets and songwriters who nobody had heard of anymore. They disappeared into past. So I began to collect these things and try to research them a bit, interpret them, perform them, bring them back to life for folk. It's a very narrow niche and it doesn't appeal to everybody, but it's, by gum, it's kept me occupied.
Yeah, and so this is where it all started, really, while you were working in a noisy factory.
That's where it all come from, working at noisy factory.
Yeah.
And Leyla Motors paid me to learn songs.
Excellent. That sounds like a good deal, that. So we'll talk a bit more about where that took you afterwards, and your marriage and your children, and after this break. And this next piece of music is Nearer My God to Thee by the Salvation Army. And we'll talk about that a little bit after we've heard it.
Thank you.
Right. Well, that was Nearer That My God to Thee by the Salvation Army. Could you just tell me, I mean, are you a religious person, or is it just something that appeals to you, that sort of music?
I were brought up in Methodist Church. My father, for many years, was minister at Lions Lane Independent Methodist Church in Chorley, and I used to go with him of a Sunday morning and sometimes sit behind him at pulpit. And you can't be brought up in a Methodist church in Lancashire without learning how to sing. And I've a lot of time for Salvation Army, which I regard as Christianity with its sleeves rolled up. They seem to do something about it. And that particular brass band tune of Nearer My God to Thee always reminds me of that Titanic film, A Night to Remember, where Kenneth Moore played Charles Herbert Lightoller, because Mr. Lieutenant Lightoller was a Chorley lad. He were born in Chorley, and his family were a family of cotton mill owners in Chorley. And Lightoller's life story is a right boy's own adventure. I would recommend everybody to look him up and find out, apart from being the most senior officer at Titanic to survive, what he did before it and what he did after it really ought to be a film of his own. So the whole thing, and just simply hearing that and hearing a brass band and having all these things that happen to me mind when I hear brass band.
You can... It's funny how we associate things with pieces of music, isn't it? As well, remember things that happened when you heard that first
time. Oh, my entire life's got a soundtrack.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right, well, we'll talk about Leyland Motors. Now, this is where you started writing and performing. So when was it that you, I mean, and I'm assuming that you got married along the way. How old were you when you got married, had children? And also, when did you leave Leyland Motors and decide that you would do something like this? Or did you go for another job first?
Oh, heck, that's a lot of going on, isn't it? Yeah. I carried on at Leyland Motors, and I was doing the same thing, night in, night out. Which is what allowed me to spend so much time learning songs and whatnot, because I didn't have to think about what I was doing anymore. And I stuck at that one because she finished at 6:10 on a Friday morning, and they didn't want to see you until 7:45 on a Monday night. And that gives a young single fella a very long weekend with a big wage packet in his pocket that he hasn't been spending all week because he's been working a night shift. And so I used to have some great weekends, going to folk clubs, singing me songs and pursuing me other interests, which is motorsport and particularly motorbike racing. So I've been out doing that all weekends, and I stuck at Leyland Motors until 1980, Christmas 1980. When I could see the writing on the wall, and I thought, this has been fun, but it's not going to last, because the investment wasn't there, the unions were stifling any growth they could do. There was all that messing about with British Leyland and so on. It was a right mess, and it was a terrible thing to do to what was a fine old fashioned English British company, but it were all going wrong. Mm. And so I thought, well, rather than wait until the bitter end and go down road with 3,000 or 4,000 other men, I thought I shall go whistling on my way on my own. And I got an offer off a friend of mine in the folk club. I'd sort of developed it. I was singing these Lancashire songs, and I was becoming a sort of general entertainer, and we formed a barn dance, a Cayley band, within the musicians that were around the Roebuck Folk Club in Leyland. And we put this Cayley band together, and they gave me a job of being the front man and the dance caller and the MC, because I can talk all night without having out to say. Which is what we're doing here today, yeah. So, and we're already doing that, and the guy who ran the band, a fella called Pete Middleborough, had a little data management packaging company, that used to be his father's company down in London, But he'd moved up here. He'd married a girl from round here whose father had a mail order business in Chorley. And he wanted to develop this. It was a little sort of artisan business. And he wanted to develop it and mechanise it and so on. And he asked me, because of my own experience of factory work and floor line principles and how these things worked. And he asked me to go and join him and to become his production manager. And he wasn't offering anything like, he couldn't offer anything like the money that I was getting at Leyland Motors. But it didn't matter because I wasn't married and had no responsibilities and had no dependents and I was quite self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to take a risk, I'll do it now. Mm-hmm. So I jacked in Leyland Motors, Christmas 1980, went whistling on my way down the factory yard, out of the gates, and started the weekend after Christmas with my new job as a production manager of a little firm. And sadly, he went bust, and I joined another company as a production manager of their, with then a data and mailing bureau, and they went bust. And I thought, oh, maybe it's me. So I started my own. I picked up the remains of it, and in 1986 or 7 or something, me and one girl that I'd salvaged from the wreckage of this other firm going bust, and I started a company, a £100 company that I snatched off a shelf called Latchwise Limited, in a little two-roomed office in Preston that I rented, and it grew and it grew, and by 1997 I had 60 staff and 25,000 square feet and 24-hour shifts and an heart attack.
Oh no.
Yeah. Problem, yeah. So yes, it's the old successful businessman's problem. But it was, as a business, a roaring success.
So what was the nature of the business?
It was a data management and mailing bureau. We used to manage companies' customer lists, associations, membership files. These were the days in the '80s when not everyone had a computer. We had a computer. We had a big ICL System 10 computer. Mm. And so we used to take people's customer lists, membership lists, and some very prestigious clients. Mm-hmm. I had for a long time, I had Westminster City Council's council tenants list on my computer in Preston.
That's impressive.
And we used to put the rents up every year. We used to print the letters that was distributed round there. Yeah. We had all the exhibitors for the Royal Smithfield Show and for the Birmingham, earlier the Earls Court, but later the Birmingham Motor Show and so on. We had some really blue chip clients, some huge, you know, Coral Bingo's membership list nationwide. Mm-hmm. We're all on our computers. And these are things when computers were the very first.
So it's a very futuristic.
We were right on the front end of all this. And that's why it grew quite a lot. And I used to get people from Preston Poly, which became the University of mm-hmm. Central Lancashire. And I used to get bright students out of there and give them a 12-month work placement and then a job at the end of it, you know.
People going to your gigs now and listening to you would probably never dream that you were a high-powered business executive at one stage.
Well, I was, yeah. Because, as I've said, by this time I'm mellowing a bit.
Right, I see. How old were you at that time?
Well, it was 19, early 80s. I'd be in my mid-30s.
Mid-30s.
Yeah.
And you're still unmarried at that time as well?
I'm still unmarried, but it was then, and I was still calling dances with band as well at weekends. Right. Oh, yeah. It was the only time I wasn't working. The pressure of running this business and being hold of this tiger's tail, it was so great that during the week, I was always working. Now, I'm so glad that we didn't have mobile phones then. At least I could get away. I had one in my car when nobody else had. Yeah, I had one in my car that we fixed in my car, you know, but it worked really well. But I don't know really. It was so difficult. There was that much going on, and I had so many bouncing balls to catch that the only time I wasn't thinking about work was when I was out with me Brown Dance Cayley band on a Friday and Saturday night, and I'm stood in front of a room of 200 people who were waiting for me to entertain them. You know, and that takes your mind somewhere else. And so, and we had a bunch of good mates, and we had a very successful band, the Old Peculiar Band. It was the best known band in north of England at that, in Lancashire at that time. Yeah. We used to work every Friday, every Saturday night, and there'd be a couple of hundred people in the audience up at Rivington Bar and whatnot.
So, and then it all ended when you had a heart attack. And we'll talk about a little bit more about that after we go for this piece of music, which is A Sooth Madamsley Strike by Brian Watson. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. Sung here by Brian Watson and a bunch of others.
If you're inclined to hear a song, I'll sing a verse or two. And when I've done, you're going to say that every word is true. For the miners of Sooth Madamsley, they never will forget Physic and his tyranny and who they had been tread. For in the midst of danger, these hardy sun betoil, the heart on that daily breeds he fear beneath the soil. They make an honest living, each miner did contrive, but ye shall hear how they were served in 1885. Oh, the miners of Sooth Madamsley, they're gannin' to make some stew. They're gannin' to boil fat postick and his dirty candy crew. The maesters will have no good soup as long as they're alive, in memory of the dirty tricks in 1885. Below the county average then, the men were 10%. Yet physically unfeeling core, he wasn't the rest content. A 10% reduction from the men he did demand. But such a strong request as this, the miners couldn't stand. The new leases was absolute, and when they had expired, all the gear was brought about, the final shot was fired. The heart is honest working men, the slowly man to strive. He locked a roof for what he did in 1885. Oh, the miners of Sooth Madamsley, they're gannin' to make some stew. They're gannin' to boil fat postick and his dirty candy crew. The maesters will have no put soup as long as they're alive, in memory of the dirty tricks in 1885. Physic was determined still more tyranny to show. And for to get some candy when he wandered to and fro, he made his way to concert where he sat for stick the boom. He knew he likes the dirty jobs and he was sure to come. Physic told him what to do and where to come and when. Then at the time appointed was the clan that were his men. With policies and were candy men, the place was all alive. All through the strike that Physic cast in 1885. Oh, the miners of Sooth Madamsley, they're gannin' to make some stew. They're gannin' to boil fat postick and his dirty candy crew. The maesters will have no good soup as long as they're alive, in memory of the dirty tricks in 1885. Commander Postick gave the word and they started with their walk. But they were done at 5 o'clock, the doors and stopped till dark. And when the done, all they could and finished for the day, the bobbies guarded Postick and his dirty dogs away. Physic was a tyrant, the owners was a shame. For the corner of the strike, they were the men to blame. And neither them nor Postick need expect they'll ever thrive for what they did to Dipton men in 1885. Oh, the miners of Sooth Madamsley, they're gannin' to make some stew. They're gannin' to boil fat postick and his dirty candy crew. The maesters will have no put soup as long as they're alive, in memory of the dirty tricks in 1885.
Right, well, we've just been listening to Sooth Madamsley Strike by Brian Watson. Can you tell me why you picked that and what sort of lead you to that sort of music?
I picked that, which is Northumbrian dialect, as you could probably hear there, because during all this time that I was working so hard at Latchwise, I only had one holiday a year, and I used to go to Whitby Folk Festival. I still do. And Whitby, of course, a bit northeast, was the place where I used to meet people who lived even further north than there in Tyneside, Teesside, Cleveland, Northumberland. And they used to come down to Whitby, and I used to go across and up a bit to Whitby. And I always, I always sort of slipped into the company of fellow dialect singers and speakers from other parts of the country. And Brian Watson was a great exponent of the Northumbrian dialect. That's an old Collier's song. And it was sung there by Brian himself. And the music was supplied by Johnny Angle and Colin Ross. And the chorus, as you can hear on that song, was augmented by Joyce and Danny McLeod, Dave Webber and Annie Fentiman. And those people I met in the pubs at Whitby Folk Festival. And we're still mates with many of them. Some have left us, sadly, but with most of them, I'm still friends with them. And I still have a lot of good friends in the Northumbrian Language Society.
Oh, very good. Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about the dialects that you cover throughout the country, really. But first of all, let's go back to when you had this business, a successful business, and then unfortunately suffered a heart attack at the age of 37.
Yeah, it were a bit early on, really. And it were very difficult to cope with, because one minute you're a successful businessman, and next minute the sky's falling in. Now, there's a lot of staff around me. It wasn't something that stopped the business. They carried on while I sort of got rehabilitated and got myself back together. But for me, it didn't feel the same anymore. It weren't as much fun anymore. And so I had one or two discussions with my fellow directors, who were all people I'd taken on over the time that the business ran. And we tried to decide what we're going to do. You know, are we going to close it down? Are we going to sell it on to somebody else? Am I going to keep it, pay them off, and, you know, reduce the level of stress and aggravation in it? And eventually they decided that they'd buy it off me and they'd buy me out. And so they paid me off. Mm-hmm. And I didn't retain any interest in it. I put a sum of money in the bank, and I thought, well, that's it. I don't need to worry about that anymore. And I've got a nice little nest egg. Okay, it was a distressed sale. I could have sold it for a lot more money, but at least it gave them a chance to keep it going. And so I went home and put my feet up and thought, right, what are we going to do now? And what I did is I turned my hobby, which is this dialect thing and calling dancing and whatnot, into a business. And Sid Calderbank, self-employed man with his own, you know, his business bank account and his UTR and paying his taxes, emerges out of it as a self-employed MC and speaker and giving talks about Lancashire dialect history.
I think storyteller, aren't you? You tell a good story, but you also tell stories that are true, don't you?
I can tell a tale.
Yeah. But so this is about, is this about the time when you started about thinking about marriage and stuff like that?
All that happened through, like it does to so many people, through your everyday normal lives and whatnot. You know, you meet a girl at a dance that you call it, you know, and I'm the guy on the stage and she falls for me on stage. It's easy to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can see how it is. Yeah. And then you've got similar interests and so, and so I married Rachel Hayway, and we got married the day before Whitby Festival.
All right.
Yes, the day before Whitby Festival in 1988,
I'm just guessing where you went for your honeymoon then.
Yes, we went to Whitby Festival for our honeymoon, yes, and dancing all the dances, yeah.
Excellent. So, did children follow? Have you got a few children?
Yeah, I've got one daughter, Liz, who is now, she's an accomplished clog dancer, and Aunt Kayleigh dance caller. She's taking over that side of the family business, yeah. Wow. Well, I ended up getting so many requests to call dances, because I'm freelance now. Mm-hmm. I'm not with the Old Peculiar Band, doesn't exist anymore.
No.
But I'm freelance now, and I work with half a dozen different bands. And I get quite often too many requests, too many jobs to do on the same night. And so Arlie's texts the weight of them off me. She's also now got her own couple of bands that she works with, so... Between us, the Calderbank Calling Company is sort of available for your band dance, folks. Yes.
And you still do that now?
And I'm still doing it. I'm doing it tomorrow night.
So when did the dialect thing come into play then?
Well, the dialect thing's been there longer than band dancing and whatnot. And I've always been singing these songs, but only at folk clubs and for my own pleasure and at festivals for fun. And it was only after I'd sold the business and sorted myself out and recovered sufficiently, you know, from everything, mental and physical problems that you get when something like that happens to you.
Yes.
And that I thought, well, I'll develop that and what I know about dialect into a series of talks for, historical societies, social groups, women's institutes, U3S, things like that. And I'll start doing some sort of MCs, after dinner speaker, and sort
that's
of
what you still do
out you want doing, out you want doing, and I carried on, and in what they now call the gig economy, but it was me just keeping myself out at workhouse.
Yeah, well, that's good, and it's something that you were interested in and liked doing, so it wasn't as stressful as what you had before, I suppose, either.
No, it wasn't. The only pressure on it was getting the work in.
And then making sure you turned up on time as well.
And then making sure you turn up on time.
Traffic can be a beggar, can't
it? And making sure that you don't get two things in your diary at the same day.
I know a few people who used to do that. I won't mention any names, but I do know somebody in particular. I'll tell you about it later. Anyway, so this all happened, and presumably you started with Lancashire dialect, being a Lancashire lad, but then it sort of developed all over the country, didn't it? Can you tell me some more about that?
Well, it did, because as I've said before, I always gravitate towards other dialect speakers, and I began to go around the country to folk festivals and things like that, regularly down at Sidmouth in Devon and Midlands and Chippenham in Wiltshire and places like that. And everywhere I went, I wanted to be in the company of people who sang in their own language. And they sang, do you see what I mean? They sang their own songs. There's a lot of people sing the same things, but I wanted to meet people who sang different things. And I wanted to meet people who were, in my appreciation, they were real.
Mm.
And they loved their area and their accent and their homes like I did.
Yeah.
And you find them, and I wanted there to be a national gathering where I could go for a weekend and, you know, we could all just celebrate what we've got. And there wasn't one. And about 10 years ago now, the Lancashire Dialect Society was on its knees. It was moribund. The membership had completely fallen off. There was only a couple of fellas who were still keeping it ticking over. Derek Stanton from Chorley and Roger Burns, who was at the time living in Whitney in Oxford. And those two had sort of kept it going. And I thought, I don't want to be around when the Lancashire Dialect Society fails. It was as old as I am. It was formed about the same time, early 50s. And I thought, I want to do something about this. So I gathered together half a dozen chums from around the folk scene in Lancashire and said, let's see if we can save it and do something with it. And so we effectively took it over. There was nothing official to take over, but we effectively took over the idea of the Lancashire Dialect Society. We drop the word dialect to give us a wider remit so that we could include all the old performing traditions of Lancashire, the song, the music, the dance and the dialect, and we could maybe provide a platform and an umbrella for Lancashire performers to work in. And they made me chairman, and having made me the chairman of the Lancashire Society, it gave me the opportunity to fulfil my dream of a national dialect gathering. So, at the Fylde Folk Festival, in 2008, I asked Alan Bell if I could have the room on the Sunday afternoon at the Fylde Festival in the Mount Hotel, which had traditionally been the Lancashire Dialect Society's competitions afternoon. And I said, can I still have that room for a national dialect festival? And he said, yes, see what happens.
And that's how it was born.
And so I rang everybody I knew all over the country, from Northumberland to Cornwall, and I said, look, drop what you're doing and come to Fleetwood. And bless them, they did. And I got some of the old Lancashire Dialect Society trophies, stuck them up, created some very light-hearted national competitions, mm-hmm. and we've set it off, and it's still going.
Right, well, we'll talk a bit more about that and about where you are today and what you're still doing after we've heard this next piece of music that you've chosen, which is Show the Room by Marianne McAleer.
And it's there I'd sit and cry my fill, and every tear would turn a mill. Nascadet o' my morning's long. Scotch yet, oh, my boy.
Yeah, that was Shula Room by Mayan McAleer, and very, very poignant sort of piece of music, wasn't it, that?
So it's a beautiful song. It's a beautiful song sung by a lovely singer. Marianne is an old friend of mine who I only meet once a year at Sidmouth.
Well, that's and, a personal friend of yours.
Yeah, not other than we meet up at Sidmouth,
yeah,
among with a great big other bunch of folk.
Of
and there's loads of people from sort of down south and London that I only ever meet once a year at Sidmouth. But Marianne, she's a beautiful singer. She wins all sorts of trophies for Irish singing, as you can hear there. She deserves them all. And I got her, that's off her CD called The Sweet Nightingale. And a few years ago, two musician friends of mine from Lancashire, from round here, decided they were going to cycle from Land's End to John O'Groats. And they asked me to be their support driver. And we stayed in my four-berth caravan. For 10 days it took them to cycle from Land's End to John O'Groats. And so we loaded everything up on my car in Chorley, and bicycles on roof, and caravan at back, and everybody else had luggage in car, and off we went down to Cornwall, and they set off on the bikes. They did about 80 miles a day. Every morning I broke down the caravan and the awning and did all the washing up and packed everything away, hooked it up back at car, drove up the road, overtook them, because eventually you pass them because they're on the A roads all the way, and went to the next campsite that we booked and set everything up before they arrived. And all the time coming over the A30 from Land's End all across Bodmin Moor and through Dartmoor and everything, and all the way up the Wye Valley on the A49, all the way up the A6 over Shap up to Carlisle, all the way up the A7 to Edinburgh, all the way from Edinburgh up the A9 to John O'Groats. I had Marianne's Sweet Nightingale playing on the car CD player. And I have driven through some of the most beautiful countryside that Great Britain has got to offer. All the time I've got her singing in the background. And it was just lovely. It really was.
I think people miss a lot of that build, the motorways, don't they? They miss a lot of the real countryside.
Oh, yeah. To go over the, you know, to go over the A7 over towards Edinburgh, beautiful, to come up the Wye Valley, you know, and you pop out from under trees and you think, yeah, this is England.
Yeah, it's a beautiful country, always. And if we had better weather, nobody would want to go abroad, would they? It's such a beautiful place.
Ah, I see. You don't want too much baking sun. We had a bit of that last year. We don't want too much of that.
Not too much.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to have a climate where it's not too cold and not too hot all year round. That'd be sort of ideal.
No, like Goldilocks.
So, we talk about Lancashire Society, which is, I think, it's online, isn't it? You have an online society.
Well, no, we've got a Facebook page where everybody sort of tells what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We started off, once we'd established the Lancashire Society, we started off with a project to record the dialects of Lancashire and the accents of Lancashire, because they're all so different from one place to the other. And we thought we've got to grab some of these before they disappear. So with quite a lot of support from the Heritage Lottery Fund, we entered into this project that we called The Noise We Make. And it's the noises we make in Lancashire, the noises of the industry, the noises of the people, the music and the voices and so on. And we wondered how we were going to hold it together, because Lancashire's a big place. And because our idea of Lancashire goes from the Mersey to Coniston Old Man, you know. And we thought, how are we going to make sense out of it and control it? So we decided to follow cut the Leeds-Liverpool Canal from Bursker on the west side of Lancashire in the rural farming communities through Wigan into the coal mines and the noise and the dirt and the dust, through Chorley and its markets where you can sell your potatoes from Rufford and all the rest of it, and into the weaving sheds of Blackburn where you've got more noise and clatter and bustle going on there. Mm-hmm. And we thought we'd follow cut, and we've been told by people who know about these things that it would have been about 24 hours worth of sailing on an horse-drawn canal barge,
right,
to get from Rufford to Blackburn, counting your miles and your locks, you know.
Yeah.
3 miles an hour and 3 locks an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And we produced that, and there is in all the libraries along that route and in the Lancashire Northwest Sound Archive, there is a collection of all the CDs and all the recordings we made of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of gave us a basis to hold the new reborn society together. And because it's Heritage Lottery funded, they didn't want us to charge any membership fees, to charge any admissions or out like that, because they regarded that as being exclusive, and you cut people out.
Mm-hmm.
If you say it's a fiver, it's 20 quid or whatever to join,
yeah,
they don't want to know about that.
No.
And so it didn't cost us to join people up anyway, so we've no membership fee, there's no joining fee, you've nothing to fill in, so we're not covered by any rules and regulations or anything like that. If you're interested in Lancashire performing traditions, song, music, dance, dialect, clog dancing, Morris dancing, fiddle tunes, mm-hmm, accordion tunes, whatever, all Victorian parlour music that was created and performed in Lancashire, you're welcome. Mm-hmm. Join in with us. And what we do now is that we ally ourselves with other organisations,
mm-hmm,
who were running events that we can go along and support. And so people like the Baron Oldswick, the Bancroft Mill Engine in Barlick, as we call it, we go there a couple of times a year to sing out songs to our mill machinery.
Excellent.
We're working with the Whittaker Museum in Rottenstall on a recreation of the Rottenstall Annual Fair in their grounds on first weekend in July. And we've got various other places that we go, and organisations that we support. And our members are all invited to come along and perform if you want, mm-hmm, or just have a chat with your mates.
Just like a forum where you can get people to go to certain events and do things, but at the same time, I suppose, when they go on the Facebook page, there will be links to places and things they can listen to.
Oh, yes, and you can see what's been going on and see what's been done. We have a secretary, if you look up the Lancashire Society, we've got email addresses for secretary and whatnot, and she sends out sort of a newsletter.
Is it one where you've got to sort of apply to join?
No, not particularly. You can just come along, you know. Anybody, you know, if you're a friend of ours and you're at the right place, you can call yourself a member, because you don't need to go through all that fuss and kerfuffle.
I was thinking because it's a Facebook page.
I know what you mean there, yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise you might get any Tom, Dick and Harry joining in, and there might be some very abusive language.
Yeah, there is a controller on that, Mark Dowden, who you might know, who's a performer. Yeah,
it's a sign of the times that you need that these days, because you get so many idiots on,
yeah,
spoiling it for everybody else. Don't you?
Mark sort of moderates it, I think, is the word, isn't it?
Mark Dowden.
Yes.
That's another guy I want to get on here. So
well, you get
if you listen to this, Mark, you're next. So,
look out, Mark.
So, from Lancashire Society, you've done quite a few gigs at Lancashire Authors, haven't you? And then last year we surprised you by asking you to be our president, didn't we? Well, I think it was in that 2017. Which
yes, it was.
Asked you to be our president. How do you think that's going?
It was a total shock, I must say. It was a total shock, and I think I said it at the time, and it's still a shock to me, because I got the approach and said, would you like to be president at Lancashire Authors Association? And I'd done entertaining for them and whatnot, and I knew of them, and they obviously knew of me. And I thought, well, you know, maybe the flippant response is to reply and say, I'm sorry, you must have the wrong number. but you obviously didn't, and I thought, well, I'm involved in lots of other things that go wrong in Lancashire, and there's the Lancashire Society, there's the Edwin Waugh Dialect Society, there's the Friends of Real Lancashire, there's the Lancashire Authors. I've got my finger in everybody's hot pot.
Yeah,
and I thought, yes, if they're stuck and they feel that I can do them a bit of good.
Yeah.
And it's a very prestigious flag for me to run up my flagpole. That's as well.
It's our 110th anniversary this year.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I think you've done as much for us as we have for you, because you've got so many contacts and you've been able to help us. We even got an auditor. I usually sort that out, but this year I couldn't, and you did. So, you know, it's something that, and then you have all these people that come up to our AGM and do performances for us that you know, and it's lovely to have that. Yeah.
Oh well, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, I'm glad it's going down all right. It can't be that bad, because I did say I'd take it on for a year to see what happened.
And you're still here.
And I'm still here, because at the end of the first year, nothing terrible had happened.
No.
And we hadn't had a big row or out like that.
No,
you know.
I don't think you will have either, because I think they're quite a friendly bunch, aren't they?
Well,
hopefully we, you know, we'll build on a membership, because I think it needs to, more people need to know about us, I think, don't they, really?
Well, it's like everything else these days, that society has moved, society has changed, and people don't physically meet as much as they used to do.
That's very true.
And you've a job to get people to turn out and do something. Mm-hmm. They're quite happy to tap their telephones and look at their computers and all sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And they're quite happy to click boxes. You know, as we discover with Lancashire Society, there's 200 and odd people who've clicked to be a member of the Society on Facebook page, because they don't have to do much about it, you know. But I feel that we've got these four organisations in Lancashire, and we're all more or less ploughing the same furrow.
Yeah.
We're all interested in the same thing. We're all interested in Lancashire's heritage and Lancashire's history. And I feel that eventually we are all going to have to roll together. We all sit together as it is anyway.
We do.
I know my opposite numbers in all these societies. And we can all sit together and say, let's do some. And I think sooner or later, it's going to have to happen, because as I go from one organisation to t'other, all the meetings start off with lists of people who are ill, ailing, or have died since we last got together. And there's precious few young guns coming along. Maybe we should concentrate our minds, make sure that we are leaving some footprints behind us for future generations, get things filmed, get them recorded, get them archived properly, structured, and so that when Lancashire needs to look back into its heritage, they can find it.
So for your last piece of music, you've chosen the Eagles and Take It Easy. Can you tell me a little bit about why you chose that?
Yeah, because it's a proper motorbiking record. And at the end of this thing, I think we should all just get on our motorbikes and ride away with the sun on your back.
And goodness knows that we should all take it easy. So, yes, thank you so much, Sid Calderbank. It's been a pleasure speaking to you this afternoon, and I hope that you've enjoyed it as much as I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy. Lighten up while you still can. Don't even try to understand. Just find a place to make your stand and take it easy. Sound of your